I want to thank you all for joining us in 2019 on Round Peg Podcast. It is indeed a pleasure to have all the guests that we had on our program, as far as Singapore, as far as Ottawa, Tanzania, London, Brussels. We tried our level best to bring some of the most thought-provoking conversations to you, and want to thank you for tuning in. And stay tuned, because 2020 is a very interesting year. A year that the landslide victory for the Conservatives in the United Kingdom, U.S. elections ahead of us, France is rejuggling and repositioning itself in the global architecture, India's economy is slowing down, and China is continuing to have its slow rise. But in the back of all of this, the question is, where are the new ideas? Where are the idealistic ways of thinking in a world that we're living and sharing in together, of building bridges, of overcoming our differences and building stronger economy and inclusive economy, and bringing in family businesses who are at the center of many of these conversations, the world of business and private-public partnership initiatives together. On that note, I would like to share with you some of the highlights of 2019 and the conversations we've had with some of the best brains around the world. So lay back, enjoy that hot chocolate or that glass of red, and listen to some of the most interesting snippets of our discussions with our guests, and stay tuned for 2020. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and may 2020 bring you bliss, abundance, peace, and serenity. Thank you. So naivety and being young sometimes do pay off.
Well,
but perhaps the most important thing is the stroke of luck for looking far, 80 miles onshore and 80 miles offshore, to see that flaring. So the optics are important. And you touched on a word, saying my mentor, Mr. McKinsey. Would you be where you are despite that courage, naivety, and youth, which I think in your case they have all been very rewarding, without the right mentor? Or do you think, that it could have taken the same path?
No. He was very instrumental in everything. He showed me how to, the art of making a deal. Let me tell you, he was amazing. He was an amazing man. He was a 6'5" Scottish Canadian guy. He was the first independent. He was the first guy to come into the North Sea as an independent. When BP said there was going to be no crude oil discovered in the North Sea, it was all gas prone because of what was in the southern part of the North Sea. He simply said, if BP said there's no crude oil in the North Sea, there's definitely going to be crude oil in the North Sea. I mean, don't kid yourself, back in the early days in Abu Dhabi when they were flaring all that gas, it was because it was too expensive. Mm-hmm. The capital cost was way too high for them to justify. They were making so much money of the crude oil, mm-hmm. they could burn the gas. Until somebody came along and said, no, you're not going to do that anymore. The fact that you're burning crude oil in a power station and flaring natural gas was absolutely obscene. And, you know, Shell and those guys in Nigeria should be taken to task for the next 50 years for what they did there and didn't do. Mm-hmm. You know, why didn't Shell put in a pipeline infrastructure? Why didn't they build gas-fired power stations? Why didn't they do that in Africa when they were making all that money out of crude oil? Because they were just taking too much money out of there. I mean, they all did the same thing. That's why natural gas took so long to develop, because it was just too much greed on the crude oil side of it.
That comes across and resonates. You've been in upstream in business, in oil and gas. You've been in midstream. You've been in downstream. Yeah. Would you agree with me that in life, ambitions and aspirations are upstream, manifesting them is the midstream, and living, loving, and sharing is downstream? Can we conclude with that note?
That's a pretty good note. The only thing is about that upstream stuff, just remember, I'm the only guy that can drill dry holes in Abu Dhabi. So but I agree with you on the downstream and the midstream for sure.
One thing that stuck with me was that when I read that Eric Molson studied chemistry at Princeton's under a professor, John Tukovich, also known as the Turk, and I think that was Globalization in Motion, a Canadian student studying under a Russian professor considered by many to be a Turk in an American university. So on that note, he had a time of his life being able to look at the frozen, burnt, or dried yeast under microscope at the lab. For an executive coach like you, I think you're in the lab of Molson family in more ways than one. So you have seen tremendous amount of dynamics in your life as somebody who's a seasoned executive herself, as an advisor to family businesses.
But was never really interested in the other businesses. His passion, Eric's passion, like you mentioned earlier, he studied yeast when he was at Princeton, and and he became a brewmaster. He went, and his passion was beer. Eric loves beer. He is absolutely, he loves drinking it. He loves making it. He loves everything about beer. Eric really loves. And so he was always, you know, at the boardroom, apparently, the questions would always go back to the beer business. And not much, he didn't really understand or was all that interested in the other businesses.
Another thing I'm very much impressed in the Molson family is that there is not much of a senior and a junior in all these generations. And that was quite refreshing because most of the time you see, I don't know, Tom Jr., Eric Sr., Eric Jr. That, I guess, is a reflection of the mindset within the family, isn't it? You don't see those references.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's culture. There's obviously that goes into this the idea of putting a junior and a senior. But in a more besides the cultural, you know, some societies put more emphasis in that. Eric never wanted his sons to follow in his footsteps. Mm-hmm. He really put emphasis on, find your way. He's convinced, or he tried to, you know, to give his sons a good education and for them to make their own choices. So there wasn't you must become a scientist and follow my path into the beer business and follow my, no, it was more, and you see that his sons made their way through very different means. And so maybe that's also part of why it's not Eric Jr. and it's Andrew. And I think part of, and that's they're lucky. I think the boys are lucky that they had that freedom to be able to discover themselves, to discover their first name, not just their last name, because their last name can take, sometimes it can take you over. And he encouraged them. He encouraged, you know, my husband, for example, Andrew, find out who Andrew is. Go away from Montreal, where Molson means so much, and discover it and find the way you can contribute.
Yulin Yang, welcome to RoundPeg Podcast. You're the Deputy Group Managing Director of IMC Industrial Group. In my head, IMC stands in terms of acronyms as an impressively massive company. Can you tell us a bit more about IMC's initials, the name, the history, where it all come together?
So originally, actually, it stood for International Maritime Carriers back in the 60s, and they got listed in Hong Kong, I think around 1972, got delisted around 2003. It was started by my mom's older brother, my uncle, and the family in 1949, when the communists came to Shanghai, they all left Shanghai. My mom actually had gone direct to New York. And then her older brother, who started the company, came down to Hong Kong, and it was very tough for him because he was 23 years old. His father, my grandfather, was pretty successful businessman in Shanghai, but was not really able to translate all his contacts and all that from Shanghai to Hong Kong. So it was really up to my 23-year-old uncle in 1949-1950 to sort of start things up and support the family. And it eventually became International Maritime Carriers in the 60s. I think they bought their first new build ship in 1966 or 67. Before that, they were using old ships, including when they started old Liberty ships out of World War II. So IMC really is most well-known in the shipping sector, particularly dry bulk, not containers, but dry bulk. And then later on in the 90s, we diversified to chemical tankers. Mm-hmm. When my uncle's son, Chavlet, our chairman and now owner of the shipping side, he came in, he diversified to ports in China, a port in Bangkok, two shipyards, one in Bangkok, one in China. Mm-hmm. And it kind of went from there. But from my uncle's time, it was really a traditional dry bulk shipping company.
That's amazing. So, so could it be said in a way you're the pioneers of maritime carriers in Asia Pacific in more ways than one? I mean, not only just moving cargo, but also developing new frontiers, new services, and perhaps being a major stakeholder in development of the GDP of these societies and countries. Is that a fair assessment?
So I think in Hong Kong, my uncle, together with a few other leading ship owners, including the Tong family, including Tong Chi Hwa, who was CEO of Hong Kong, but it was, I guess, Tong Chi Hwa's father, my uncle, YK Pao, there are a few of them who kind of were pioneers to become ship owners. You know, until then, they were, you know, of course, British colonies, and the ship owners tended to be the British ones. So they were, yes, pioneers in terms of being Asian ship owners back mm-hmm. then. Of course, the situation's evolved a lot since then. Now you have a lot of Chinese state-owned as well as private owners. But back in the 60s, 70s, yeah, I would say they're pioneers. I think my cousin was a pioneer in terms of, say, Thailand, where he established the first and largest shipyard in Thailand.
What is the view and optics from perhaps where you're sitting with IMC on Belt Road Initiative? Because normally you have been on the bulk maritime shipping services yep. and carrier inbound to China. But China's yep. ambitions are as well expanding to Africa, to, you know, Middle East, to Levant. Do you see that some of your ships are bound to take, I don't know, for many of these infrastructure projects, dry bulk cargo to other destinations for Chinese clients? And what is your view on Belt Road Initiative at large?
So maybe take what we see as opportunities that we're pursuing. So, you know, I think in countries like India, Bangladesh, you know, they're going to need more power, particularly coal. So our ships also carry coal. So we actually are pursuing some projects where we're transshipping coal for them, building basically floating ports. So, mm-hmm. You know, I think there'll be opportunities in that regard. I think Singapore has a little bit of concern because maybe Singapore, some of these new ports, and when they get built, will be they'll get bypassed. Mm-hmm. I think that for shipping, we sort of feel it's going to be maybe less long haul ton miles, and it'll be shorter haul trade. But I think that's an overall trend. I think McKinsey did a very good report a few months ago, and they said, "Hey, global trade is shrinking. Mm-hmm. It's gone down by half from a few years ago." And that's because a lot of it is there's China will produce for the Chinese market. So it's kind of regional supply chains rather than the old model where Asia rose up, where the West outsourced production. You're shipping shoes and, you know, electronic goods back to the Western world. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be less of that. So there's more data and services also being traded rather than just product, which is based on cheap labor. I think on Belt and Road Initiative as a whole, I had the opportunity to moderate a panel on it, so I got a little bit of knowledge from my other panelists. So I think it makes a lot of sense for China. I think there's a lot of criticism in the Western press. Some of it is fair in the sense that, well, you know, can these countries really afford it? Are you putting them into debt traps, et cetera? At the same time, the U.S. did its Marshall Plan after World War II, and that had both economic as well as strategic goals. So I think for China, Belt and Road Initiative, it makes a lot of sense. Who can build ports and railroads the best? The Chinese can. Mm-hmm. They've done it for China. They can do it for the rest. I think geopolitically, for China to swing back to Europe, which is basically the old Silk Road from 1,000 years ago, makes a lot of sense. It's kind of shifting away from the U.S. It also unleashes, opens up China's west.
Correct.
And I think it also opens China up to energy sources and, you know, like gas from one of the stand countries. Mm-hmm. Also, from a shipping standpoint, I think they have concerns about a lot of their oil. Most of the oil goes through the Malacca Straits. So now when you have, say, gas pipelines across Myanmar, it shortens the sailing distance and you don't have to go through the Malacca Straits. So I think for China, it makes sense for economic and geopolitical reasons.
Do you feel that sometimes there's a sense of naivety from, continental Europe or the States when they look at developments in Asia Pacific, thinking that they know it better than, you know, the local population there? And my point is that, complexities in Asia Pacific will have tremors and effects across the globe. And I think sometimes being separated by both Pacific Ocean and, you know, Indian Ocean and Atlantic Ocean, sometimes the grasp of the West or the Western world as such is not as in-depth in understanding the intricacies and the history. What is your take? What are your concerns about what's happening at the moment in Hong Kong as a business, as a family business, and at large, the continuous stability of Asia Pacific?
Wow. Okay. So, we shifted our headquarters from Hong Kong to Singapore back, I think, in 91. It was before my time, before I joined IMC. I think Singapore as a whole feels it's going to benefit with a lot. I think people will divert to Singapore rather than Hong Kong. You know, I think Hong Kong, or maybe let me take a step back. You know, my mom left Hong Kong age 20. She's been in the States for 72 years. She was a U.S. ambassador under Clinton to the Asian Development Bank. So she's very American. However, when it touches on some of these issues, she, you know, including at the Pacific Pension meetings, reminds people about history. So I think something that Westerners do not remember very well or don't know at all is history. So, you know, China thinks of, you know, hundreds of years at a time, while the U.S. history itself, and I'm born in America, is only, 250 years old. So, you know, for example, the current treaty negotiation, the trade tariffs and all that, I think it probably brings up memories within China about the unequal treaties imposed in China and, you know, during the Opium Wars in the 1840s. Or, you know, when I visited the Summer Palace, it's pretty, there was somewhere they say, hey, the British and the French burned down the Summer Palace in 1865. If I talk to British or French people, I don't think they know that. Correct. Or a few years ago, took a friend of mine from college, and we were in Beijing. We took a leisurely one day through the Forbidden City, and there were pictures of U.S. Marines camped out in the Forbidden City because after the Boxer Rebellion of 1899 and the eight legations, you know, a lot of the troops came into Beijing, including U.S. troops. So, you know, how would the U.S. feel if China had Marines camped out on the White House lawn? So, you know, I think Westerners don't really appreciate maybe that, hey, Asians remember the colonial era. My grandfather worked for a British company, I think ICI. But, you know, there's kind of that resentment. They were kind of treated like second-class citizens. They did benefit from living in, I think it was the International or French Concession of Shanghai, but you are treated as a second-class citizen or regarded as such. And so I think there's lack of understanding of history and the feelings of people, and, you know, is it really the Western system is the best? I mean, I personally think it is. I'm from America, but there are a lot of things to say that, you know, there are other systems that work too.
So if Canada could decide on its own merits, its own business, trade, economic relations, and U.S. as well, and yet both of them would have vowed and renewed this vow every year that we are the best partners and let's continue to grow that. But if there is a hiccup between United States and India or Brazil tomorrow after, you know, a Bolsonaro administration, Canada should not suffer because of the positions of its largest trading partner. That's my argument. Nobody's discounting the importance of the, you know, over $300 billion of trade going up and down this longest border on a daily basis. That's not my point.
I guess what I would say is that up until this present U.S. administration, what we had was a respectful relationship of interdependence, mm-hmm. where both of our countries felt that it was in the interest of both of our countries to build the relationship, to deepen it, and to make it stronger. What has changed was the election that put into the White House in Washington someone who has a mercantilist view of trade and who's quite prepared to turn his back on the model that the United States has followed over the course of literally several generations. Mm-hmm. also has been attacking multilateral institutions that the United States was instrumental in creating, the Bretton Woods institutions, for example. First, we should not assume that that will always be the position taken by the United States. That's mm-hmm. the position taken by the current administration. But secondly, what is significant here, and the message that we're trying to give to Canadian business, is that we can no longer complacently take for granted that we will have that mutually beneficial interdependence where we're working to help each other.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the government that brought in the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, one of the assumptions on which that was based was that our two economies were so closely related and our two peoples so closely joined that neither partner would deliberately inflict damage on the other.
Mm-hmm.
That changed when President Trump launched a series of trade actions against Canadian products. It changed after the G7 at Charlevoix, where he threatened the Canadian automotive sector and where he made very very serious overt attacks in terms of our political leadership. That particular individual is the incumbent and today. So we need to take a long view of our relationship with China, we certainly need to take a long view of our relationship with the United States. And our goal there should be to restore a relationship of mutual respect. Having said all of that, we need to go beyond that. We need to diversify. And there are more reasons than simply, will Washington be hostile to what Canada wants to do? The simple fact is the fastest growing economies in the world are not in the traditional economies. Many of them are found in Asia and elsewhere where Canada has not had deep relationships in the past. And you want to go where the economies are growing the most rapidly.
One topic that has always hovered around my head is that Canada is fantastic at creating some amazing stars, but many of them turn out to be shooting stars. And in building and sustaining and growing global champions, we have at times been a bit, here and there. Case in point, Nortel, case in point, BlackBerry, and now Bombardier being bought by Airbus. What do you think is missing in the recipe?
Ali, I don't know. I'd be a very rich person if I could give you a not. The fact is, we are as entrepreneurial as anyone else in the world. And surveys show it and other studies that are done. We are good at seeding companies and getting them started. But great ideas, great technology and so on. Where we're not successful is in growing Canadian entrepreneurial companies to mm-hmm. world-class scale. We have a handful of companies that are world beaters. An example of that would be one from here in Ottawa, Shopify, mm-hmm. Which has just been doing outstandingly well. But these are the exception as opposed to the rule. And, mm-hmm. and so very often what you find is that a Canadian will start a business. They'll get it past the valley of death, to where it's commercialized and operating, and then it will be sold to a foreign company. Mm-hmm. Often the R&D that was developed using public funds. So Canada has a very good system providing public support for R&D. We're less successful in terms of encouraging private sector R&D. But often this R&D paid for by tax dollars
mm-hmm.
ends up being lost to Canada as a result of the loss of ownership from Canada. The focus that we would like to see at the Canadian Chamber is not putting restrictions and saying you cannot sell a Canadian company to a foreign entity, but rather, how do we create the conditions in which a Canadian company can remain in Canadian hands and scale up to global size and be a world beater?
Well, that brings me to a very new frontier for Canada, and being a descendant from a family with temperance values, what is your take on the contribution of cannabis and the $7.5 billion of boost to Canadian GDP? where is that going? And there are even talks now about infusion of spirits and drinks with cannabis. So it's a new category. It's where is all of this going?
It is, and I'm hoping my grandfather isn't listening to me.
Yeah, exactly.
This is an area where there's a startup Canadian industry, which is going exceptionally well, and where Canada's a potential for being a leader in the world. It is clear that jurisdictions increasingly are legalizing and normalizing the use of cannabis. So this is an industry, a sector that is going to continue to grow. And there's the potential for Canadian businesses, having established themselves in this market and scaled themselves up, to be able to be truly global in scale. So it's something the Canadian Chamber is working with the sector on. We do support it. How it's going to evolve exactly, I don't know. So much of it depends on local legislation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so it's an industry or a sector which is going to evolve rapidly, but in ways perhaps that we don't even anticipate today.
What I felt in love with most of all was what was the impact these entrepreneurs had in the less developed world, mm-hmm. i.e. at the bottom of the pyramid, not only in terms of how they'd created services mm-hmm. where the very poor could pay for them, but employed the very poor and became scalable large businesses. Mm-hmm. And many of those companies today are known in the world market. So I saw how much good these people had created for society. So I went to the author of the book and went to visit him in Michigan. And he sat me down with a class full of MBA students and said, I have this person who lives in Dubai. He's got some questions for you. He would like to know, and then he passed it over to me, how can we create more and more successful entrepreneurs in the world today? And after 45 minutes of discussion, they came up with this was in 2007, where financial capital was freely available. They said, wouldn't it be great if every entrepreneur was helped by a mentor? Mm-hmm. So as I drove away, minus 20 degrees in the snow, that's where mentoring came in, first of all, mm-hmm. as a highlight.
Is a mentee, is there a precondition for a mentee to be mentorable? is there a characteristics in when you say every human being needs a mentor, fine. But do mentees have to as well have the ability to receive and to digest the nourishment they get? Because, you know, you can give everything you want, but how much of the onus is on the mentor and the mentee? Not keeping the conversation there, because then I want to move on from there and to say, you rightly said a lot of times we've had mentors without knowing we had mentors, but what is the responsibility of a mentee in a relationship?
So the driver of the relationship is the mentee. Mm-hmm. From the start, in the middle, and to the end. Mm-hmm. That is the driver. So if a mentee, for example, has a high degree of ego, mm-hmm. Who has many other aspects of hubris around him or her, it's unlikely that they're very easy to mentor.
So that brings the politicians in immediately.
Okay. Human development around is made of two elements, two legs, in fact. Human capability, mm-hmm. and human capacity. Mm-hmm. And you gain the human capability through competencies. Mm-hmm. You gain your human capacity through failures and learning from failures and growing mm-hmm. in your own confidence level mm-hmm. to take on the risk, that risk of failure.
Do you agree that there's tremendous amount of a facade and building, and these days people feel that if they show their vulnerabilities, if they show their weaknesses, if they show their failures, they're looked down upon rather than, you know, celebrated or acknowledged. People come out and talk about their failures, Tony, after they've gone through it. Very few have the guts the day of failure to come out, to share it, to show their wounds and to say, I failed. You know, you always hear about outstanding entrepreneurs after making their billions that they say, oh, I used to live in a cardboard box. The first part, they don't come and talk about it. Do you think that we at large need more work on humility and vulnerability for learning, or, you know, it's part of the game and it's normal to be how do you say, camouflaging your failure.
So I'm going to park that. Because
you need a big parking, Tony.
I know, you're going to park that. Okay. Because there's something of greater concern to me is that the parenting today of kids is such that the parents don't want to see their kids fail.
Mm-hmm.
Where they've got to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And the earlier you start them failing, the better they are for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't let them fail when they're in their 5, 6, 7 for the first time,
mm-hmm.
and then again and again and again throughout schooling, and then in life, and each of those is a small failure, and then they grow up on that. Mm-hmm. So I think that is my biggest concern around.
Mm-hmm.
I think humility is always an asset.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you've been through failure a number of times, that humility comes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
When you have failed because you can't get access into clients, or you failed because you've not got any cash to pay the bills, those are real humbling. And you go home and just tell your wife you can't afford any money this month.
Back in the 80s, it was easier, I would say, mm-hmm. to show results to the public,
mm-hmm.
To show impact, because you had two superpowers.
Correct.
And you try through back channel diplomacy to improve relations.
Mm-hmm.
That was easier to show to the wider public. Today is much, much difficult, way much more complex, because there is no world order anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What we see, what I call, is actually it's a world disorder, right?
Correct.
It's a multipolar world. It's a disordered world, and also, we live in a kind of a paradoxical age, I would say,
mm-hmm.
Where I see technological progress and political poverty mm-hmm. going hand in hand. So I'll get back to your question on how do we judge our own impact, but just if I may just to delve a bit more on that paradoxical age, the age of technological progress and political poverty. So we are all familiar with the great technological advancement, and I think we all as humanity are benefiting from it, but what we see at the same time is the unraveling of political ideas,
mm-hmm.
is the bankruptcy of the factory of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So while we are making these great shifts and transformations in the sector of technology, we are lagging behind in producing new ideas, mm-hmm. global, progressive mm-hmm. ideas, which bring people together.
How do you see the reconstruction of Middle East at large and Levant, Iraq, Syria, uh-huh. Libya?
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you think really, after all the complexities of the past two and a half decades in particular,
mm-hmm.
is there a greater and growing role for China in this, do you think, in terms of mm-hmm. both capital, appetite for risk, for mm-hmm. deploying resources, being on the lines of Belt Road Initiative? Or do you mm-hmm. think this will be, again, a wrangling between East and West and mm-hmm. and who's going to be at the forefront of reconstructing all of this carnage and destruction?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, China is quite present in the region, and aims to bolster its strategic presence, through its also this One Belt One Road initiative, But what I miss right now is really lack of leadership, mm-hmm. Lack of ideas also, particularly from the West, mm-hmm. from the West part of the world, to come up with an inspiring narrative,
mm-hmm.
In addition to money, but also inspiring narrative
mm-hmm.
about the strategic importance of a reconstructed Middle East for global stability,
mm-hmm.
And that is lacking. That is lacking because most of the governments, they deal with the day-to-day businesses. Of course, there are a lot of talks of contributing, and also some commitments to reconstruction in Iraq, which is very welcome, actually. But still, I mean, you asked me about the wide the Middle East as a region.
Mm-hmm.
I miss that really. that inspiring grand global narrative, in addition to money, to be part of the reconstruction of Middle East. That is missing. Some, you know, inclusive, global, progressive, inclusive ideas. You know, so we have, as I said, you know, technological progress, but we suffer from political poverty. Mm-hmm. What to do about that? Mm-hmm. So what you need for that is investment in ideas, mm-hmm. you know, ideas that bring people together. Mm-hmm. And I think also, you know, business families could play, you know, a role in that. You know, we have the issue, you know, the biggest challenges of our era are climate change, refugee, you know, and some other issues, cyberspace. There is a lot of need and space for investment in you know, ideas which would bring, you know, try to develop common global solutions for these challenges.
I'm going to move a minute to your vision for the future embassy. I mean, in your book, you talk about a UK embassy in Sweden, which is a thought-provoking image, and I really liked it. I think Greta Thunberg would be very happy with you grounding ambassadors in future and minimizing carbon footprint through flights and, you know, all virtual things as you've tackled in your book. But isn't there as well a gap between having a proper protocol for the rules of engagement in cyberspace today in the world across the board, and, you know, some certain big powers still reserve the right for themselves into hack, intervene, you know, influence other countries' infrastructure. Isn't it a bit like Wild West at the moment, Tom? I mean, doesn't the world at large need a set of conventions and, you know, a digital treaty conventions of how, you know, countries, regardless of their size, you know?
Yeah.
Is that not the first thing to be looked at rather than just saying, how can we hit them first? Because then it turns into another race that is without any, perhaps, structure.
I think we certainly do need to, I would say, upgrade the existing conventions and rules that we have. Actually, you know, if you look at the Geneva Convention, you know, the way that protects our liberties, it can just as easily apply to our liberties online. If you look at the Vienna Convention and the way that codifies diplomacy, again, you're not talking about huge changes in order to make that more relevant to the digital age. So I wouldn't rip apart the existing guidelines that we have. But, you know, again, when you come back to the tech companies, they're saying, look, don't come and find us in 20 years' time and tell us that what we're doing now was wrong or illegal. You know, tell us where the lines are, tell us where the rules are, what the ethics of the internet. So there is a huge amount of work to be done there, not just in establishing the rules of the road, but then in actually in enforcing them and holding people to account. And there we run up against this real challenge of this lack of trust in authority and institutions, and the fact that, you know, at least three permanent members of the UN Security Council are actively disrupting that international model already.
That brings me to geostrategic issues in Middle East and Levant, the opportunities, the challenges. Belt Road Initiative is a reality, Tom. It has already started. It's snaking through many of these geographies. I was reading the other day in Financial Times that a Tulip Group of hotels with their Chinese holding have bought four hotels in Syria. And do you see a great part of the future of perhaps Mediterranean hubs and trades, because of their high risk, because of, you know, the complexities they have, more of a playground for China and Belt Road Initiative? And should UK capitalize on that and be part of it, or just be a bystander and say, you know, we're not going to be contributing to this dialogue because, yeah, China and, you know, and all of things China. What are your thoughts there? And I'm happy to weave into.
So I you know, without doubt, power is shifting east. I feel that very clearly. I live in Abu Dhabi now, and you can sense the way in which people in the Gulf are looking increasingly at the opportunities that lie east as well as west. And that trend is, you know, that's going to be a huge feature of our lifetimes and my kids' lifetimes. It's not going to change. I think I think the UK can approach these issues, I think, with greater humility and modesty. And I think one outcome of the last 2 or 3 years will be that we'll be looking at the world through slightly different spectacles. We'll be framing it slightly differently and trying to construct this more modern 21st century identity rather than falling back on empire and, you know, the amount of the world was colored pink and so on. Now, so without doubt, you know, China's a huge factor in that, and we'll all have to find a way of working with China, working with the grain often of that Chinese expansion.
There are themes and threads that, you know, I really enjoyed. I learned a lot and I didn't find any of it boring, even in one page. But there are pages as well that I want to challenge you on and some topics. In one of your lines, you say one man's propaganda is another man's spin, is another man's public diplomacy strategy. Isn't there a hue and flavor of double standards in global diplomacy that we lurk back, we harp back, and we forget about that, you know, we have been in those places? Why is it that George Bush Sr. is not an ex-CIA, but Vladimir Putin is every conversation in ex-KGB, you know? Why we have to constantly polarize it, you know? And isn't there a new chapter for bringing some dialogue into healing, humor, and moving forward? Otherwise, the tectonic shifts will be there for years to come.
I completely agree. And in a way, that's what I was trying to say, really, with that line about, you know, one person's spin is another person's public diplomacy is another person's propaganda. We're very quick to label anything our opponents say as propaganda while thinking that we are completely innocent and virtuous. I think to be honest, social media is shifting the ground on this so fast anyway. I think mainly because it gives people more of a sense of their critical faculties, more critical thinking. They're much better able to realize the humbug that might come from their own countries and call it out. They can see the inconsistencies.
I have to interrupt you there. I learned humbug first in your book, then heard it from Boris Johnson. So credit to you. But carry on.
I wouldn't say it's a very commonly used word, actually. You don't hear it a huge amount. But I think in this case, it's that idea that, you know, you can kind of get away with bluffing and so on. And look, there are some leaders in the world today who have got away and are getting away with a certain amount of bluffing. But I think that gradually the public and the international public are getting better and better at seeing that for what it is. And so that's one of the positives of social media. I think, look, you're dead right. We do need to make those connections. We do need to reach out and understand other cultures. One of the things I'm working on now that I love is this system for teaching and assessing global competence, which is the ability to have the cultural understanding, the antennae, really, to understand other cultures and to empathize with them and to find ways to work together beyond differences. And a lot of people call that 21st century skills, but I call that diplomacy.
Once again, thank you very much for joining us on RoundTech Podcast. I wanted to wish you all a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, wherever you're celebrating, whatever you're celebrating. May 2020 be a year of great health, bliss, peace, abundance, and serenity. See you in 2020.